Thanks for downloading from WRTI. This is Jim Cotter. For more information on this and all the other programming you hear on the station, go to our website, wrti.org. While you're there, you might consider becoming a member, renewing your membership, or making an additional gift. This podcast and all of the programming you hear on WRTI is made possible by our listener members. Why not become one now? Thanks, and enjoy the show. Hello, on this week's program we speak with archaeologist Victor Mayer as the Penn Museum opens its latest, newly revamped exhibition, Secrets of the Silk Road. Susan Lewis looks at how the Mendelssohn Club is expanding the concept of choral performance, with a little help from its audiences. David Patrick Stearns profiles the Ecuadorian-born, Philadelphia-based composer Diego Luzuriaga. And we speak with David Contasta and Carol Franklin, authors of Metropolitan Paradise, The Struggle for Nature in the City, Philadelphia's Wissahickon Valley, 1620 to 2020. That's all ahead this morning, creatively speaking.
Support for Creatively Speaking comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.
After an undisclosed snafu threatened to cancel its first real blockbuster, the University of Pennsylvania Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology, the Penn Museum, has now fully opened Secrets of the Silk Road, an exhibition of more than 100 rare objects from China, including mummies and artifacts, some dating back as much as 4 millennia. Originated by the Barrows Museum in California, the travelling show's third and final stop at Penn will have a shorter run than originally planned due to what is being described as a miscommunication between the Penn Museum and Chinese officials. The Penn Museum has some of the finest Chinese holdings anywhere in the world. Yesterday I spoke with Victor Mayer, a professor of Chinese language and literature at the University of Pennsylvania, a consulting scholar at the museum, and the cultural consultant and catalogue editor for this exhibition. So the controversy surrounding this exhibition, we hope, will not have taken away from the drama inherent in what's actually in the exhibition. Tell us about the genesis of this exhibition and what your reaction was when you thought that it might not be.
Well, the exhibition really goes back about 20 years when I began my investigations in 1991. And I took my first expedition in 1993 to study various aspects of the mummies. And there was talk of an exhibition back in the 90s, but we couldn't pull it off because we didn't have climate control. We just couldn't handle it. So to have the exhibition here now, I mean, the museum, those three galleries had to be remade, and it cost a lot of money. Actually, the exhibition was organized by the Barrows Museum in Santa Ana, California. And the president of that museum called me up in February of 2009, and said, I'm going to have an exhibition of the mummies from Xinjiang. I said, no, you're not, because it's not in the cards. It's not going to happen. He says, yes, I am. Do you want to be involved? And I said, sure. And then he said, do you want to have it at Penn for the third venue? And I couldn't believe it.
And when you looked at what he'd got on board in terms of antiquities, what was your reaction?
I thought, it's incredible, because usually, if China has an exhibition like this, they only have maybe 4 or 5 or 6 what they call class one pieces. And this exhibition has around 20, which are, you know, treasures from that part of the world. So it's really extraordinary that we would have so many of these top pieces in one show, and then a total of over 120 pieces. So that's, I just couldn't believe that they would let this happen all at the same time. Two mummies. One of the mummies has never been shown outside of China before, and neither of the mummies have been shown in North America at all. So there, you know, just the fact that this is happening at all, plus how superlative it all is kind of mind-boggling.
The holdings that this museum has are among the finest Chinese holdings in the world, and I didn't even preface that by saying outside of China. What was the reaction of the Chinese officials when they saw what you had, or were they aware of it?
People in China have long been aware of our holdings. And for example, we have those Tutong horses, which are like the Elgin marbles of China.
That's what I mean. They're national treasures.
Yeah, oh yeah, absolutely tops. And everybody knows that. And for example, when the president of China, Jiang Zemin, visited here about, I don't know, 8-10 years ago, I actually took him through and showed him those horses, and he was happy and satisfied that we're taking good care of them.
What are they doing here, and why aren't they in my backyard?
Well, we know how we got them. We bought them from a Chinese art dealer, and they were legally obtained in those days. That's the way things were done. And nobody has ever asked, they don't ask for them back. It's not, and it certainly hasn't been related to this mummies exhibition at all. It has never been raised in the slightest.
Despite the bump in the road that in the lead up to the opening of the exhibition here, it does augur well for further relationships between this place and China, now that you've actually managed to get your heads together and finally get an exhibition open. Yeah. What have the conversations been about the future?
We'd like to take our students over to get involved in field excavations. We'd like our staff to do that. And, of course, just general cooperation. So we'll probably have more exhibitions from China. And we've already sent a lot of our best pieces over to China for long-term loan, Mesopotamian stuff. So this is part of an ongoing process. It's not going to stop with the end of this exhibition.
Would the horses ever be allowed to go to China?
Possibly, under the right conditions. But they, you know, we just finished conserving them, and the Chinese were involved in that conservation, which shows that they're certainly aware they're here, and they helped us to conserve them.
Victor Mayer, professor of Chinese language and literature at the University of Pennsylvania and consulting scholar at the Penn Museum. Secrets of the Silk Road, with all original artifacts now on display, is at the Penn Museum until March 15th.
You're listening to Creatively Speaking on WRTI.
The Mendelssohn Club in Philadelphia is a champion of new choral music, having commissioned 45 works in the last 23 years. The choral group has explored not only new repertoire, but new, different ways of performing it, with some recent concerts adding dance and other theatrical elements. Now, as it prepares for its latest program, WRTI's Susan Lewis looks at how the Mendelssohn Club is further expanding the boundaries of choral performance with audience participation.
Choral music has been around at least since ancient times, when the Greek chorus was an integral part of dramatic performance. Over the centuries, the repertoire has included madrigals, masses, cantatas, and oratorios. Great composers have written for the art form, from Bach, Mozart, and Beethoven to 20th and 21st century artists like Philip Glass, John Adams, and David Lang. But the concert experience is no longer limited to listening quietly to a robed choir singing from risers on a stage, at least at the Mendelssohn Club.
That's actually a fairly boring thing to look at. You know, if you have 120 singers standing stationary on a stage.
Alan Harler is the Mendelssohn Club's artistic director.
When you think of the whole history of culture, it's only sort of a recent event that music was performed for an audience that came in and sat still and followed the rules of applauding at the right time.
And so while the Mendelssohn Club, as a symphonic chorus, does perform the choral masterworks,
another important part of our mission has been to do new American choral music and also to explore what will be the performance experience in this century. Everyone sees that that's probably going to change. For classical music, we're not maintaining audiences in the same format that has been around for a long time.
The Mendelssohn Club has already been flirting with change, collaborating with the Leah Stein Dance Company for commissions by Pauline Oliveris and David Lang. Works performed in the non-conventional venues of a rotunda and the armory, respectively. In Lang's work, Battle Hymns, audience members at one point moved to the center of the performance space.
The singers and the dancers moved around them. It ended up being a very dramatic part of the piece, so that encouraged me to go further.
Change has also been prompted by a study by the Greater Philadelphia Cultural Alliance, Engage 2020. It showed that performing arts groups do a good job of getting audiences, but not in retaining them, says Janelle McCoy, executive director of the Mendelssohn Club.
We know that people are interested in the arts on their own personal time. They're doing artistic things. So how do we bring that personal level of engagement back into our venues and our performance halls?
Next week's program is part of an effort funded by a grant from the Wallace Foundation to better engage audiences. McCoy says choral music provides the perfect context for this research.
We use our voices from the time that we're born. We learn how to speak and articulate. at some point you're listening to the radio, you're trying to sing along. So singing is something so universal that it makes sense to figure out how can we tap into that personal practice of singing.
The project has included a website that posts rehearsals, singer blogs, and other windows into the creative process. Thinking of music that would lend itself to audience involvement, artistic director Alan Harler came up with a program of three works. It opens with the Durafle Requiem, a liturgical work in which each movement is based on a medieval chant, chants the audience will learn, kind of like this.
Aeternum. So see right there, you almost have it.
Audience members can also learn the chants online, or the night of the concert, or at an open rehearsal, like this. Harler says singing the chant before the movement in which it occurs will keep the melody in the minds of the audience.
So that it will be totally in their ears. They will actually have tried to make the music of that chant. And I think it will connect them much more closely to the music in which this chant is happening.
The second piece is Bernstein's The Lark, written as incidental music to a Lillian Hellman play about Joan of Arc. The play will be read, with the audience assigned the role of the crowd. The final work was specifically commissioned to include audience participation, something its composer, Rollo Dilworth, an associate professor of music education at Temple's Boyer College of Music and Dance, grappled with at the beginning.
I wondered how it would be possible to get the audience involved in such a way that their participation would contribute in a very tangible way to the music itself, the performance. I didn't want the audience to just have these sort of token experiences, but that they would really feel as though without their participation, the music would take on a different kind of form or would not have as much meaning.
In the second movement of his work, Rain, the audience will hum Amazing Grace, as it did at an open rehearsal.
So that's what they're going to basically do while the choir is singing When Storms Arise. And it is basically in the style of a hymn, but there are some jazz harmonies in there.
Dilworth, who grew up rooted in the African-American traditions of gospel and jazz, was also classically trained from the age of 7. He likes to blend various styles and techniques.
No longer do we see choral music being pigeonholed into one particular category. Influences from around the world seem to be coming together to create new types of techniques and new palettes of expression.
The final movement is an arrangement of an American spiritual called Didn't It Rain, with the audience making percussive sounds by clapping or hitting their laps, creating the rain. The work challenges the choir with new ideas as well. In the first movement, jazz and gospel elements are set to a poem by Langston Hughes, In Time of Silver Rain. In African American music, says Dilworth, certain words get different emphasis.
And so I have the choir singing the words silver, like they're very short rhythms, like droplets of rain. And in the word time, the choir has to sing, in time of silver rain. Because for me, the word time is important. So we're sort of stretching the vowel. And that's very much sort of an African-American styling in that you hear in the gospel tradition.
A concert that combines innovative musical composition, traditional repertoire, and an invitation for the audience to be part of the performance. Risky programming? To be sure. This kind of art is not for artists of faint heart.
You want everything to be, you know, at the very highest artistic level and to be perfect. So you start thinking in terms of what would a critic think if the audience is actually interfering, you know, into the perfection of the performance.
But what is perfection in art? It has to be something more than absolute control and accurate technique, say both Harler and executive director Janelle McCoy.
Art is living and breathing and meant to inspire, and it's not meant to be so precious.
And without the risk, it's very unlikely that anything's going to happen creatively.
Live performing arts always involves something of the unknown. Playwrights say that the audience and how it reacts becomes the last character in the play. Even the Philadelphia Orchestra is encouraging occasional non-musical engagement of the audience from the stage. This choral experiment goes one step further, exploring a new, or perhaps old, idea of what a performing art should be.
WRTI's Susan Lewis. The Mendelssohn Club performs in concert next weekend on Sunday afternoon at 4 at the First Baptist Church of Philadelphia in Center City. The Philadelphia Orchestra's recent Inca Trails concert at the Kimmel Center promised some stunning visuals of the Andes and exotic sounds from composers from along the Inca Trail that connected what is now Ecuador, Bolivia, Peru, and parts of Argentina. Not so expected was the discovery of a locally based composer, Diego Luzuriaga, who is 55 and has been teaching in Wynwood near Philadelphia for the past decade. His operas, oratorios, and concertos have been performed from his native Ecuador to Tokyo to Minneapolis. So, why hadn't we heard of him? The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns discovered that it's not because his music is quiet.
All composers have their own singular journey to artistic maturity, but Diego Luzuriaga's took side roads from the most remote villages of Ecuador to the most rarefied circles of Paris. In one way or another, his music reflects it all.
My idea was, can I compose a piece of music where there's a drumming from beginning to end? If you go to a folk festival in Ecuador, you go to the solstice festivities high up in the Andes, you hear drumming, not for 1 minute, not for 10 minutes, for 3 days. So I said, why not compose a piece on that vein? But instead of just one drum and one flute, you use a symphony orchestra.
The result was Responsorio, the piece that was introduced by the Philadelphia Orchestra following successes in Baltimore and Tanglewood, where Peruvian conductor Miguel Harth Bedoya has performed his Inca Trails concerts. But when formulating the program years back, the conductor wasn't exactly struck with the idea that some Luzuriaga might be rather nice to hear. He had to hunt around before discovering him and his music.
I started building a network of, I suppose, collaborators or future collaborators, composers, performers, literally through the internet, colleagues of mine, searching by countries, by musical periods. So doing my own research, and composers of Ecuador, various ones, and the name of Diego Luzuriaga came up, and I just wrote him an email, and he happily replied.
But not from Ecuador. He lives in suburban Philadelphia with his wife and children and teaches at Friends Central School in Wynwood. And as much as Luzuriaga enjoys going to concerts in Philadelphia, he hasn't been in touch with Network for New Music or Orchestra 2001, two groups that might be interested in performing him. Music is not his primary reason for being here.
My plan was to stay in Ecuador. Well, I was busy there. But for the health of my daughter, with special needs, and she couldn't be taken care of properly in Ecuador, so we moved to here.
Luzuriaga did enter a Christmas carol contest in Minneapolis a few years ago and won. That led to a relationship with the famous Minnesota choral conductor Philip Brunel and, increasingly, a place among the Latin American composers being embraced by a larger world. The Argentinian Osvaldo Golioff is one of America's most sought-after composers. Younger ones, such as Gabriel Lelina Frank, are also doing quite well. Two common characteristics that Harth Bedoya hears in Latin Americans is their ability to immerse themselves so completely into any given commission that they're constantly reinventing their methods of composition and doing so in ways that has a visceral effect on audiences.
The intellect doesn't interfere in presenting the music, in the presentation of the piece. I just find that the music is as direct as it can be.
That visceral effect appears to arise from a strong sense of cultural identity. Diego Luzuriaga spent his first 27 years getting music from sources untouched by modernity. In the remote southern Ecuadorian province where he grew up, he spoke the archaic Spanish of early colonialists. But that wasn't nearly as remote as the villages he visited with his musician buddies, armed with a reel-to-reel tape recorder to make field recordings of everything they heard. But also having heard symphony orchestras on the radio, Luzuriaga realized he needed more training than Ecuador could then provide. Thanks to some scholarships, he's lived in London, Brazil, and New York, where he studied at Columbia University and the Manhattan School of Music. More importantly, he went to L'École Normale in Paris, where he worked at the IRCOM Electronic Music Studio and was inspired by cutting-edge composers, as illustrated in this flute work titled Yaravi.
I did the whole trip around the world. I went to France. I studied with the composers, and I was influenced by spectral music, Tristan Mireille, Gérard Griset, which was à la mode in those years.
This was the kind of music he was hearing.
But then, little by little, I came back to my own traditions. But the music that I kept in my mind from those years. And then I think, I hope I have made a good round trip.
Yet traditions lurk behind traditions, ones that Luzuriaga can only guess at, but are reflected in responsorio.
Some people told me that some of those melodies sound Japanese. And I said, oh, I thought I was composing Ecuadorian music. If you go to the countryside in Ecuador, for example, you can hear pentatonic tunes that I bet have been in the air for 400 or 500 years. There's this theory that 20,000 years ago, the Americas were populated by peoples from Asia, right? Yeah, there must be some connection. The melodies tend to be, in general, pentatonic.
However fascinating this confluence, Luzuriaga seems oddly lackadaisical about sharing it with the rest of the world.
I'm not that in a hurry, I suppose, to push my work, even though my friends and families say that I should. I have a web page newly redesigned by my 14-year-old son. I enjoy my basement. I compose sometimes for the pleasure of composing, but mostly because I have commissions, and that makes me happy.
One wonders what other riches might exist in those field tapes he made years ago, especially now that the world has a greater appreciation of Latin American cultures.
And you still have those tapes?
Somewhere. I don't know. At some point I worked for an institution there, and we did plenty of recordings there, and then I suppose they kept all those tapes. But the most important recording place is up here, right? The memory. The most important archive, should I say.
Perhaps only a fellow Latin American, namely conductor Harth Bedoya, could explain why Luzuriaga is happy to have music live in his head rather than preserved in more permanent ways.
For us, music is not music that we learn in conservatories or in music school. Music is a lot more part of daily life in Latin America. People make music, they sing, they dance. When the Europeans arrive in the Americas and they heard music, they heard a lot of music, and all of this is recorded in testimonials, in letters, in diaries, everybody was making music. That concept of I'm going to hear music didn't exist for a long time. Music was part of your life, whether it was for work, for harvesting, for celebration. And a lot of that is still part in our culture. So there are a lot of, you know, musicians and composers like Diego Luzuriaga that are around, and some of them still don't write their music. also I've come to learn that the biggest difference in trying to differentiate either classical music or concert music or popular music, whatever it is that we want to call it, because we can't really find one good term. I think it's music that is written and music that is not written. I think that's the biggest difference in the genres of composing music.
It's a bit hard to imagine music that one lives rather than learns. But for Lizarraga, what he lived is maybe his greatest asset.
In Ecuador, actually, it's a common place for artists to complain that the country doesn't do anything for me. I need money. I need a scholarship. I need free tuition. And I bet that's true, but the memories of my childhood, the melodies I heard up there in the Andes, those things were provided by my culture, by my country. And that's not a small gift. And I thank my country for that, my culture, for providing me with those things. And I'm using them all the time.
So let's hear it more now.
The Philadelphia Inquirer's David Patrick Stearns. The Wissahickon Valley, a northwestern section of Philadelphia's great sprawling Fairmount Park system, has been pivotal in the history of America and for centuries a source of inspiration for artists. This 9-mile-long, densely forested gorge has been the subject of paintings, music and literature for centuries. Today, though still beautiful, the Wissahickon is in a state of flux. Its water is polluted, its native plants struggle to survive, and decades of bureaucratic apathy have left the care of the gorge to voluntary organizations. The history of the river's lower valley, the Wissahickon Gorge, and the middle valley, the Meadowlands, directly beyond Philadelphia, are told in David Contosta and Carol Franklin's Metropolitan Paradise, The Struggle for Nature in the City. It's a compendium divided into four volumes, Wilderness, Park, Valley, and Corridor, each approximately chronological, but also reflecting how different socio-political, economic, artistic, and ecological trends have impacted the past, present, and even future of the Wissahickon. Let's cover the pre-park era. Wissahickon, the name means yellow river?
Well, it's a conflation of two different words, one of which means yellow-colored stream and the other catfish stream, and it seems to be a conflation of the two. It's a Lenape word.
Carol, the area we now know as the Wissahickon Gorge, the park area, is a tree-lined gorge. Ecologically, how was it pre-park?
There is a lot of discussion of how very different the forest was then, both because of missing animals, like the passenger pigeon that flew in their billions over Philadelphia. And the other thing is the missing trees, such as the chestnut tree, which died in the blight starting in 1904.
But so when you say missing, you mean those trees and plants existed pre-forest, but they're not there
yes,
today,
Yes, it was
right?
a very different-looking forest. The hills were white with chestnut blossoms and yellow with the color of chestnuts in the fall. And they formed at least a fourth of the forest.
The development of the area as a park was related to protecting the watershed so that Fairmount Park Waterworks would work.
Yes, right? It was related to several things. There was an intake just below where the Wissahickon went into the Schuylkill. And, of course, the city of Philadelphia began creating parkland along the Schuylkill to protect the water supply and then the Wissahickon. But Frederick Law Olmsted came down here from New York and advised the Fairmount Park Commission in 1867 that they ought to begin taking the Wissahickon, not only for hygienic purposes in the water supply, but also because of its wildness and because it would make for wonderful carriage drives and recreation. So it's a dual purpose. It's recreation as well as to safeguard the water supply.
The main thoroughfare that runs through the Wissahickon Gorge, called Forbidden Drive, were motor vehicles always forbidden there?
They were not at first. Cars started showing up in Fairmount Park in the late 1890s, and then people wanted to drive up the Wissahickon to Mount Airy and Chestnut Hill, and they kept applying to the Fairmount Park Commission for permission. This would have resulted in widening the road and cutting down some of the hillsides The mayor of Philadelphia, I believe, in 1920 said that if people really were sincere in trying to keep cars out, they should have an equestrian demonstration, which they did in October of 1920. They rode their carriages and their horses. Then Fairmount Park Commission forbade cars, and that's why the road is called Forbidden Drive.
David Contosta and Carol Franklin, authors of Metropolitan Paradise, The Struggle for Nature in the City, Philadelphia's Wissahickon Valley, 1620 to 2020. Out now on St. Joseph's University Press. And that's our program for this week. You can find an archive of past shows and subscribe to our podcast at our website, wrti.org. Creatively Speaking's theme music is by Bill Jolly, orchestrated by Tim Ripchester, and performed by Symphony and Sea under music director Rossin Milnoff. Eric Brannan is our associate producer. The show's executive producer is Jack Moore, and I'm Jim Cotter.
Creatively Speaking is a production of WRTI in Philadelphia. Support for the program comes from the Pennsylvania Council on the Arts and the listeners of WRTI.